The floor is yours, Marcos.
Well, thank you very much to Oxford Transitional Justice Research for the invitation, and especially to Ezequiel and Annalen. Thank you very much for taking the time to go through my book and to be here to discuss it. I really look forward to hearing your thoughts about it, especially of such a dear project to me that I've been working on for so long, being my doctoral project, and it seems that a very, very long process, but finally I can see it sort of physically embodied, and that's good. So I want to start actually with four images that open the book, and it has to do with what Ivo was saying in terms of like what's the breadth of transitional justice, and that's something that I have been grappling with since I started working on this area. So here I go. First image. Two men kneel on the dusty ground facing each other. A gourd filled with a brown liquid lies between them. They lean forward with gravity and drink deeply from a vessel, keeping their hands clasped behind their backs, the sides of their heads almost touching. They are surrounded by members of their clans. Second image. A woman wearing a black robe stands behind a long table. She wears headphones and talks into a microphone. She's questioning a man sitting behind two computers on an individual table. A group of people sits at the table around the woman, another group sits at the other end of the room. Between the two groups, on a raised platform, three men in black robes with scarlet trimmings listen. More people watch on this scene behind a glass screen. Third image. Three men and two women sit behind a long table facing an audience. The man in the middle wears clerical collar and a heavy crucifix. An enormous flag covers the wall behind them. The whole room listens to a man who is recounting how he was beaten. Other people wait for their turn to speak. Fourth image. Behind an iron fence stands a solid white building. It has a portico with four columns and two rows of windows. Underneath the coat of arms in the face of the portico, it reads in Spanish, Naval Mechanics School. Between two of the columns, a banner reads, Space for Memory and the Promotion and Defense of Human Rights. A group of students walk up the steps and into the building. So these four images describe different practices taking place in different contexts, in different continents, in completely different situations. There's a reconciliation ceremony in Uganda, an international criminal trial in the Netherlands, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearing in the Solomon Islands, and a human rights memorial in Argentina. So what do these disparate images have in common? And the answer is that they are all referred to as practices of transitional justice and recognized as such by a specific discourse that appeared at a particular moment in time with certain characteristics. So what I want to do, what I started thinking when I started my PhD and what I tried to do in the book, is to look into what constitutes the discourse of transitional justice and trying to understand how it came into being, what effect it had on the world, and look at the history told of itself. So the main claim in the book is that the emergence of a particular discourse of transitional justice has framed which contemporary and historical practices of different ways of responding to past violence are considered valid, while others are ignored. So crucially, I made a distinction between what I call transitional justice practices, which are any responses to past widespread or systematic violence, and that can be applied to like as a label to any practice of the present or the past. In contrast, the discourse of transitional justice, I argue, it is a historical a historically bound phenomenon that appeared at one point in time and with certain characteristics. And I use the analogy with medicine to emphasize this distinction. In the first place, or on the one hand, we have medical practices. And so any practices throughout history that has been used to heal the body, that can be applied to all contexts, in all cultures, across history. On the other hand, if you're talking about medicine as a sort of science that has a specific history that is confined to a particular point in time, and it's not a historical, like medical practices widely understood. So with this that distinction in mind, in my book first I look at transitional justice discourse today and identify six characteristics that are predominant within the discourse. Some of them are more self-evident than others. It is a comparative discourse that relies on contrasting different situations in different places. It is it prioritizes technical solutions, and this technical characteristic has three dimensions. It is a multidisciplinary discourse where different disciplines meet. It favors legalistic options, not just trials, but any solutions that are, there's sort of like a spectrum of legality. With one end we have trials, but other truth commissions or reparations, they also operate within a legalistic framework. It appears apolitical, although as I discuss a bit later, it isn't. It is teleological in the sense that it's always geared towards a set of goals. It also has a powerful liberal imprint manifested in a preference for civil and political rights, liberal democracy and capitalism. It operates at several levels and it also favors state-centric responses. So what I do is to trace these characteristics at the process of emergence of this specific discourse of transitional justice that I argue took place in the 1980s and 1990s around four formative moments. I'm not the only one who has argued this, but I think that a very important moment was the democratic transition that took place in Argentina in the early 1990s, where after a brutal dictatorship with widespread human rights abuses, a truth commission was established to find out the fate of the disappeared, and criminal trials were conducted against those responsible. However, due to military pressure, those trials had to be rolled back, and that this sort of sowed the seed of later the truth versus justice debate that we still grapple with today. However, at this stage there wasn't a discourse of transitional justice as we know it today. There were different people talking about these issues, but there wasn't a coherent discourse. However, this sort of set the ball rolling for this sort of debates, especially as more and more countries in Latin America primarily and then elsewhere began similar process of democratization. The second moment, as Ivo also mentioned before, was sparked by the end of the Cold War and the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe. This generated a lot of interest in which path the newly democratic states would take, and one of these areas was what they would do with the abuses of the previous regimes. And this in turn generated an interest in transferring lessons from the Latin American transitions to these new countries that were perceived to be following a similar route. And this sort of lesson learning and transfer process took place through meetings, conferences, and research projects that sought specifically that they brought together people that had been involved in Latin American transitions with people that were politicians and other influential figures in the former communist countries to try to transfer lessons. And around these sort of meetings and events, an epistemic community of academics and practitioners with an interest on issues of what we now call transitional justice began to coalesce. The third moment in this sort of process of emergence had to do with the reinvigoration of international criminal justice that was inaugurated with the creation of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in 1993, and the following international and mixed criminal tribunals. Although until that moment, all these transitional justice processes in Latin America, in Eastern Europe and elsewhere had been largely domestic processes relying on domestic law. These new international institutions that relied on international law and were created by international organizations were immediately incorporated into transitional justice. And therefore, the discourse became much more international. The fourth moment in this process was sparked by the creation of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission in 1995. This institution, which was much more ambitious and had a much wider remit than prior truth commissions, such as the Argentine one mentioned before, also adopted a language of redemption and reconciliation and healing that I argue opened or paved the way for more multidisciplinary approaches to transitional justice, as well as helping to unmoor the nascent discourse from purely judicial responses. In particular, because the South African TRC was envisioned not as a sort of subpar response in the faced with the impossibility of trials, but actually as a mechanism that was on an equal footing with criminal trial. So these four moments, I argue, both gave birth to transitional justice as we know it today, with certain concepts, certain themes, certain actors, but at the same time, within this breath that I described before, they consolidated these characteristics I mentioned before, and in much more detail I trace these characteristics to these particular moments. For example, while the comparative trait started to emerge quite clearly with the Eastern European movement, for example, as I just mentioned, the multidisciplinary characteristic was really cemented with the South African TRC. Also, this process wasn't linear. There were a lot of moments of contingency and rupture that I also emphasized, that it wasn't like this sort of predetermined appearance of this fully fledged discourse, but it was quite an accidental occurrence in many ways as well. However, and this I think marks a pivotal point in my book, once the discourse emerged, it sought to write a history of itself. It tried to trace an older history and a history that actually predated its actual emergence. So when quite early on histories of transitional justice began to be written, they weren't traced back to Argentina or to any of these moments I mentioned before, but they traced much older origins, in particular back to the post-World War II period. So this prehistory of transitional justice that actually predates its emergence as a autonomous discourse has been highly selected, and certain episodes that reflected the characteristics I highlight have been emphasized, while those that didn't have been marginalized. So the point of origin for transitional justice is widely considered to be the Nuremberg trial at the end of World War II. And I think that Nuremberg served three purposes within the discourse of transitional justice. First, it provides a sort of mythological point of origin that provides a new and fragile, to an extent, discourse which a much older and illustrious pedigree. Second, it serves as an example of a point in time where there was political will and resources to carry out a widespread and policy of trials and other transitional justice mechanisms. And in that sense, over and over in later transitional justice situations, they refer back to Nuremberg as this sort of like exemplary period. And thirdly, by providing a common ancestor between transitional justice and international criminal justice, it facilitates this incorporation I mentioned before. So if both of them are creatures of Nuremberg, both of them are kinship and can be understood in the same framework. However, as certain aspects of the response to the violence of World War II, like Nuremberg in particular, has been emphasized, other aspects have been totally marginalized. In the first place, the Soviet Union was instrumental in carrying out the Nuremberg trial, and it also carried out many more trials than the other occupying powers. However, their contribution is largely omitted from the history of transitional justice and international criminal justice more largely, to be honest. And I think this has to do with this sort of liberal bias within transitional justice. Second, the German economic system was blamed for the war, and therefore the Allies sought to respond to this economic dimension by putting to trial economic ministers, bankers, industrialists, and at the same time carrying out a very ambitious program of reforming the German economy, breaking monopolies and cartels to try to address this. However, this important dimension of post-war transitional justice has been ignored as it sort of clashed with this emphasis on civil and political rights and this sort of support for unreformed capitalism. Thirdly, with the end of the war, there was a huge wave of popular justice, extrajudicial punishment that has also been largely unaddressed by transitional justice, because these practices, while problematic in many ways, also were certainly not legalistic or state-centric. So, the point of origin of transitional justice, as I see it, marginalized all these episodes. At the same time, between this sort of like mythological point of origin in 1945 and the actual emergence of the discourse in the 1980s, lie 40 fallow years in which, from a sort of historical transitional justice perspective, nothing happened. And although it was true that during the Cold War years there weren't any international criminal tribunals like there were at the end of World War II and later, as I mentioned before, with the end of the Cold War, however, during this period, human rights, both as a legal framework and a political movement, saw a fundamental, a phenomenal growth, and in many ways, these transitional justice movement that developed, as I mentioned, in the 80s and 90s was certainly an offshoot of this human rights movement in the 1970s in particular. So I think that that's a very important prehistory of transitional justice that is important to emphasize. However, at the same time, many other aspects of these 40 years of the Cold War period have been totally marginalized as well, because they didn't reflect the characteristics of the discourse. And in particular, I discuss three particular historical situations and events that took place during the Cold War in which a specific and quite particular transitional justice mechanisms, again understood as societal responses to past widespread or systematic violence, were implemented that have been largely unaddressed. The first one are the many proxy conflicts that took place between the superpowers during the Cold War. And this haven't been systematically addressed by transitional justice, certainly not the role of the superpowers in those conflicts. And also there are some interesting mechanisms that were implemented in that regard. For example, the 1967 Russell War Crimes Tribunal that was created by Bertrand Russell and included philosophers, writers, scientists, and other intellectuals, lawyers as well, and passed judgment on the conduct of the United States and its allies during the Vietnam War. And this has been largely considered an episode of transitional justice, again, because of the prevalence of the sort of legalistic, state-centric characteristics. The second moment, I think that's very important and haven't been taken into account, is the process of decolonization that completely changed international landscape over a couple of decades, and this hasn't been systematically addressed by the discourse either. However, although there weren't truth commissions or trials in which those responsible for the colonial violence were brought to book. However, these newly independent states carried out different policies to respond to the colonial violence. However, these policies didn't fit the transitional justice framework, as mostly addressed socioeconomic issues, for instance, through land reform programs or other policies that try to sort of redress the socioeconomic imbalance that characterized the colonial period. Thirdly, although transitional justice has been mostly concerned with liberal democracy, liberal transitions, that meaning transitions from some sort of authoritarian or period of conflict to liberal democracy. During the Cold War, certainly there were many transitions that were certainly not liberal and were in some way or other inspired by Marxist thought. From Vietnam to Cuba to Mozambique, these different transitions implemented also mechanisms to respond to what they perceived as the violence of the previous regime, that in many cases had a colonial element as well. These responses also largely departed from the transitional justice mechanisms that we know today, although there were many trials of former members of the former regime, including war crime trials in some contexts. However, most of the effort was placed on socioeconomic reform. And in between socioeconomic reform and trials, one interesting mechanism that I highlight in my book are the raft of popular tribunals that were created in these non-liberal transitions, by which there were tribunals that were created featuring non-lawyers as judges and had a dual purpose: on the one hand, to respond to the violence of the past, but also to reform society and bring about this sort of new regime that they envision. So this has been like a very broad brush run through the book, and I look forward to having some discussions with the panelists and also with the general audience. And I would be happy to provide much more detail if you ask me, because I know I had to run through this. I want to conclude with offering with four final thoughts. So the first one is that, and I think it's a key finding of my book, is that although most, if not all, definitions of transitional justice on the face of them are apparently value-free and are similar to the one I adopted as well, is like a descriptive sort of task in which certain practices can be identified as transitional justice practices. In practice, through the influence of these characteristics, It has an implicit normativity that is very powerful and operates as a filter, including certain practices of the past and present and excluding others. The second is that, in particular, this sort of framing process results in the exclusion of the sort of economic sphere understood as the sphere of production, labor, and distribution that's largely left unaddressed as a huge blind spot of transitional justice, despite recent efforts to broaden transitional justice in this regard. Thirdly, and I touched upon this earlier, the history of transitional justice is not a linear continuity from Nuremberg to the present time as an inevitable march towards progress, but is in fact the result of accident, contingency, certainly of some sort of larger structures and historical movements, but it is not. Transitional justice doesn't need to be the way it is today. And that leads me to the fourth and final point, which, because I like to finish with a sort of optimistic note, and the fact is that discourses can and do change, and they are changing as we speak. So while the characteristics of transitional justice have proved to be powerful and having this inertia I described before, they can change, and they can change through discussions, they can change through reframing these particular categories and concepts, and this could lead to a more inclusive and, I hope, effective transitional justice. And I'll leave it here. Thank you very much. And that was like, I don't know, 300 words in 25 minutes or something.
Yeah, so. You did well. Thank you very much for the invitation. Hi, everyone. Congratulations, Marcos, for a wonderful book. It's phenomenally well written. It's incredibly well researched. This is a book that tells you the history of transitional justice that we're all sort of familiar with. It tells you the prehistory of transitional justice, and it tells you the hidden history of transitional justice. And for anyone who's immersing themselves in the topic for the first time or who are experts on the topic, this is just a wonderful resource in its own right. I think the most important contribution of the book is to sort of conceptualize transitional justice as a discourse, as a historical construction that is then used by policymakers and academics, and that is itself a construction of policymakers and academics, a historical construction that reflects a lot of the historical circumstances that gave origin to these discourses in the 90s and the 80s. But also a discourse that reflects the power distribution at that time and also that distributes power further down the line, right? Empowering certain actors, legitimizing certain demands and not others, certain solutions and responses to those demands and not others. And like any other sort of Foucauldian archaeological exercise, like the one Marcos, I think, does in this book, is that this sort of book removes the Burkean veil from transitional justice and exposes us, if you want, to the truth about it. And that truth can sometimes be uncomfortable. That's why Burke wanted that veil to remain over certain things in society. And so it reveals it as a sort of value, completely value-laden, completely non-neutral a sort of discourse and set of practices. In many ways, it challenges the idea of liberal neutrality behind transitional justice. And this is important because I think it forces proponents of transitional justice to rethink the way one defends transitional justice, because it's not something that we should take for granted, although it is something that states debate, perhaps as a matter of course, when they confront violent pasts. But the ways in which they deal with that past doesn't have to be governed by inertia. It could be something that we think and rethink if we accept, as Marcos challenges us to do, that transition. There's nothing objective, there's nothing obvious about this particular tool set as opposed to alternative tool sets to deal with the past. And so in sort of deconstructing this idea of transitional justice, Marcos digs very deep into history, and I think here is the other contribution of the book, which is that he's contributing to this turn in the historiography on human rights that is trying to decenter transitional justice and trying to look at the contributions from the periphery, if you want, of the world. Marcos is Argentine, I'm Argentine as well, and it's always kind of nice to see the reflections on the historical importance of rather peripheral countries that have done a lot of contributed a lot to the way in which we understand what these things are about, what these things mean, whether and under what conditions they are possible. So together with a new generation, I think, of historiography, this book is trying to show that, that transitional justice is by no means a northern imposition, although there is power, although there is, you know, there are structural forces at play. There is also an agency from the south, if you want, and I think that's interesting, not only because it feels empowering, but also because it's part of the truth, I suppose. If there is anything like the truth. Now, this is a book about paths not taken. It's a book about docks that didn't bark, right? About ways of doing transitional justice that didn't gain salience in the discourse or legitimacy as practices. And this is something that's extraordinarily hard to do. I mean, as a social scientist, to study negative cases, cases in which things are not present, is very, very hard. Because there's a huge burden on the researcher to show that the dog could have barked. That it was indeed possible to think of popular tribunals, of land reforms, of all of these things as transitional justice, right? So it is always a challenge to make that argument and to be convincing, right? In part because in this case we're dealing with discursive practices that we all are part of, that we all have been affected by, and so sometimes that revelation can be very uncomfortable, and sometimes it's very hard to sort of buy into that argument. So it's an uncomfortable book in that respect, trying to convince us that these dogs could have barked, but they didn't. So the core argument, as Michael said, is that the discourse of transitional justice develops certain features, right? And this discourse then reads the past in search for continuity, for legitimacy, for pedigree. And in reading that past through that discourse, it selects certain things and leaves others out of the narrative. So in many ways, this discourse biases the reading of history and sort of constructs, like most histories, a selective picture of the past. And this is, I think, a provocative argument. And as such, I think it raises two key questions that, in terms of debate and in terms of future research. So the first question is conceptual, right? So as I said, my reaction to a lot of the case studies about paths not taken was, well, this is not transitional justice. You know, this is not a dog that could have barked, right? But then, you know, I kept reading and I reached the end of the book, and let me just read you the very last sentence of the book, which I think summarizes the argument very neatly and sort of pushes me to think further about this. He says, reflecting on the images that he talked about at the beginning that also opened the book, he says, they are held together by the discourse that recognizes them as relevant practices of transitional justice. The history of the emergence of these discourse and the retrospective narrative of its origin explain why these widely diverging practices are considered examples of the same phenomenon, while other comparable responses to past widespread or systematic violence are not. Right, so I think here's are the two polar opposites of the debate we should have about this book. One is, Marcos is right, these dogs could have barked, and the other one is, well, no, these are not instances of transitional justice. They could have never been instances of transitional justice. And so, if you ascribe to the first sort of Marcos's position, then of course that means that we need to embrace a very minimalist definition of transitional justice, one that simply looks at policies that try to address past violence, right? And then that a certain number of discursive features sort of latch on to that definition, right? By some historical process that Marcos describes. And then that's why, you know, the community looks at some practices and not others, although all of them look at the past and try to address past violence, right? So that's one position. The other one is that actually these discursive features that Marcos has pointed out, liberal, state-centric, technocratic, and so on and so forth, are actually definitional. You know, they're actually what the concept is, rather than discursive features that pervert or latch on to the concept to discuss, to distort our reading of history. The reason I think I'm putting this forward is because one could argue that if you have a definition that's too minimalist, then you could write an endless number of histories about the paths not taken. You could choose any sort of response to past violence and say, well, why hasn't this been considered transitional justice? So in many ways, there's a risk of the argument being pushed too far and say, well, you know, we could write three volumes of this book with a huge number of paths not taken. And the question is, well, could those dogs, could have they barked? You know, that sort of idea. And if indeed we are engaging in conceptual stretching, and some might argue, then those omissions from the history of transitional justice are less puzzling and less problematic, because they're just not transitional justice. So yeah, that's sort of, I think, the key debate that this book is forcing us to have. And the second issue, and with this I'll end, that I think this book raises, not so much in terms of debate, but I think in terms of future research on this topic, especially for social scientists, has to do with the explanatory dimension of this argument, which is, okay, so we have some paths that have been taken and others that haven't, or some things that have been incorporated into this history and some things that have not. Why? Right? Why has this happened? And so the book doesn't say this explicitly, but it opens one of the chapters with a beautiful, beautiful metaphor about this guy who's trying to explain or reconcile the Bible with fossilization, with the fact that people were finding lots of remains of dinosaurs and so on. Brilliant. And so the idea that this guy comes up with is that, well, these fossils were planted, right? And so the analogy here is that, well, you know, the discourse is planting mythical origins in history and sort of selecting the ones that are convenient and ignoring the others. So there is a sense that there is choice here, that there is a purposeful, I wouldn't say deception, but at least a purposeful exercise of historical selection. And so this is a possibility, right? It's certainly possible that we are in the face of some sort of, I wouldn't say Machiavellian, but definitely some sort of purposeful historiographical exercise. So the question for future research is, well, how is it that this happened? What are the actors that embody this discourse that did this? You know, why did they do this? What was the agenda? Why Nuremberg and not Tokyo, right? And Marcos gives us some clues as to why this might be the case. Why Nuremberg and not Greece? Why did Alfonsine think about the Nazis and not about the Greek generals, right? And which were much closer in time and so on. Why Argentina and not Bolivia in the founding history of transitional justice, right? So what was the way these actors perceived these things, and why is it they, if indeed they did still purposefully, why did they go for one and for some of these examples and ignore others? But there's alternative mechanisms, if you want to use social science language, about why is it that some things got selected and others got selected out, which has nothing to do with choice. It might be that actors look at certain historical reference by default as a function of what they know about, as a function of the way they were educated, or the cultural frameworks, and of the knowledge they had of things. So it's probably likely that that the Argentine at least were not very much aware of the Greek experience. In fact, most Greeks weren't aware of the Greek experience. So it's not only natural that they looked at the Nazis or the responses to the Nazis. There's nothing sort of, there's no choice there, if you want, it's just inertia. Social networks might play a role in terms of which actors were able to be more connected and nodes in those networks and therefore managed to diffuse certain ideas and not others. Maybe it's just a function of utility, right? So for example, in the case of the map of the trials or the economic reforms in post-Nazi Germany, it would have been unthinkable in many of the Latin American transitions to sort of think in those terms simply because the conditions were fundamentally different. Marcos talks about the fact that this, you know, the idea of looking at the role of concentrated industry, it doesn't make sense in very poor countries where there isn't any industry to begin with. So maybe it's just that. Maybe it's not choice. It's just that some things are thinkable, and some things are unthinkable because of the, and quite literally unthinkable because of the over context. And so, for example, today in Argentina, we see courts beginning to address issues of corporate complicity. We begin to see an international movement to sort of try and generate a sort of treaty or legal framework to address corporate complicity. And maybe that's because now it's thinkable, because now conditions have changed, because now we know exactly how these things worked in the context of the Argentine repressive state-sponsored terrorism, and therefore we can sort of address them in court and that sort of thing. Anyway, I'm going to stop there. Thank you.
Great. Well, first of all, thank you. I really enjoyed this opportunity to read the book and engage with it. Maybe two caveats before I start with my comments. So on the one hand, I am a German lawyer, and we talked a lot about Nuremberg, but with a focus on Latin America, both in practice and in my PhD. And I'm also a practitioner doing lots of transnational litigation, so that's also where some of my ideas and comments come from. Maybe first on the book in general, I very much enjoyed reading it, as did Ezekiel. And very much enjoyed the focus on transitional justice as a discourse and to really develop that and separate it out from practice or try to separate it out and to see where both come from. While at the same time broadening the perspective. In that way, I think you really did a wonderful job of freeing transitional justice in the book, at least, maybe beyond, from its historical limits and self-imposed limitations as well. And I think it's beautiful how you bring to light the blind spots, which you also showed and shared with us here in the presentation. One of the elements I would really like to focus on in my comments is the links to human rights as a concept, language, and the influence it had. And there you also recognize that it had had a lot of importance for the transitional justice discourse, that was in the presentation. You also highlighted that, in the book you mentioned three factors why it was of such importance. On the one hand, the development of international human rights law as such, as a body of law. But then also the advocacy and the growth of this movement of human rights, and lastly also foreign policy. And I would actually really like to focus on the first two especially. So I think the parallels in this development are quite striking, because after Nuremberg it wasn't only transitional justice and human rights, it was also international criminal law, as you highlight. Maybe also, you know, this whole in continuing process of constitutionalization is also something we can trace in parallel. And I think that would be a really interesting additional exercise to have a look at how these developments mirror each other, find strength in each other, and how they are intertwined. And I think there are lots of quite concrete impacts the human rights movement and discourse has had on transitional justice, which I think also looking at the history and the conceptualization of it is actually quite interesting, because of course we're focusing here on transitional justice as a discourse and as a term as such, but where does it come from? So I think, you know, for me reading the book often I was asking myself why, you know, why did Alfonsine say there should be a trial of the military junta? What made it possible at that point? What were the developments internationally? And I think there it's really interesting also to highlight the role of the regional human rights mechanisms. You also talk about the UN and other organizations as well, but there, for example, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights has played a role often much later, and the most important judgments were Espalios Altos, but then especially more in the 2000s. But also the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights, which already during the Argentinian dictatorship, you know, published a report on the human rights violations as such, but then later on also took quite early on a stance on the duty to investigate and prosecute, and you also sort of trace that history and Diane Orentlicher's article on the duty to investigate and prosecute. But I think it's quite interesting to see how that sort of doctrine against impunity is the counterpart, in a way, to transitional justice, and phrases this movement and sort of plans the way for it as well. And on the role of the advocacy movement, I would really like to also highlight the importance of the social movements behind asking for transitional justice and also, you know, using the discourse of human rights and later on transitional justice in pushing for those goals. Because I think, for example, I don't know, starting with the Stasi archives in Germany, which you also mentioned in the book somewhere, it wouldn't have been possible had the people sort of taken control of the building de facto and sort of asked for them to be published and made available to the victims and those mentioned therein. And same with the networks more globally, I think we also notice the development of transnational networks supporting both human rights but also specifically transitional justice. And a good example of that is the whole universal jurisdiction as a tool of litigation, which of course the most famous example is Pinochet, which is probably just after the focus of your book, because I didn't see it mentioned. But this whole idea of a justice cascade, which Catherine King also mentioned, I find quite fascinating. And I mean, there are a couple of instances where maybe it wasn't strictly under the principle of universal jurisdiction, but for example, with the Eichmann trial, you also mentioned there are some links, or and then also with Argentina, many of the cases which were pushed in Europe as well, and then sort of came back to Argentina and raised the pressure as well in Argentina for the second wave of investigations. There's a first case in France already in 1989 against Astiz, for example, also, and a conviction. I think it's just interesting to have a look at those cases as well, and to see how the discourse in those cases and why they were brought forward and how that was argued, then again influenced the broader developments in transitional justice. And also because my second focus besides transitional justice is on business human rights, I also wanted to comment a little bit on the economic sphere. And I think it's really important to highlight the blind spot which transitional justice has had over many years. And also I found it interesting that you illustrated the extra difficulties where attempts were made to both transition sort of politically but also economically. And there you mention Eastern Europe as one example, but then also the sort of non-liberal transitions, right, which often took the reverse transition towards a more socialist or communist regime. So sort of Eastern Europe and Cuba as two examples. And I think it's just really interesting to see how difficult that actually is once we broaden the sphere to actually address it. But on the other hand, I think it's also interesting, as Ezekiel also now mentioned, that finally, maybe over time, it's possible to have a look at those questions, because I think it's really important to actually understand the underlying reasons for the conflict, the root causes which led to it or to helped it prolong the conflict in time. And so in Argentina, I'm not sure if it's only now, I think it has been also discussed early on, and sort of the recognition that was a civil political dictatorship as well really already leads in that direction. And of course Nuremberg is really interesting, because already in the mythical moment you had those couple of trials, even if not the broader reform be completed. And Argentina, I mean, just at the end of last year, Mercedes-Benz, the case finally was concluded and ended with a conviction of several of the directors or members. And I think it takes a lot of time to get there, and it will be interesting to see now where Colombia goes. But I also think it's interesting to have a look at the transitional the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions and their work, because some of them, also the earlier ones, do make mentions of economic reasons behind it or economic actors involved. When presenting the South African Truth Commission, you also mentioned that some hearings were held in that regard. And Lee Payne here in Oxford also just published something sort of on lessons from various Truth Commissions also in the earlier times. So I think it's also really interesting to see what maybe bits and pieces are in that regard. But I have to agree that it continues to be a blind spot, and I think it's important to think about how to change that. And it's very much linked to the overall question of how to challenge power in a globalized world, right? And that's the part where I want to end on, also the role of law and who has access to justice. Because you explain, and when you talk about the legalistic, technical characteristic of transitional justice, that often the lawyers are insulated in their legal sphere, and as a sort of more of a transnational movement lawyer person, I felt really a challenge, because it's true that often we withdraw ourselves to the purely legal. And I think lots of people actually involved in the movement do want to ensure that they are connected to the movements and the networks as such. but how do we do that? So what are the lessons learned for today also from your book? And yeah, so I think it's really important to have those social movements and to learn maybe also discursively how that worked out back then, but also what can be learned for today also in this regards to other forms of transitional justice. I think it's really interesting, this is the Russell Tribunal back then, but nowadays there are also, like, there's recently in Germany and Congo, the Congo Tribunal by Loma, a sociologist but also a theatre person, which was quite big, and you know, it also has a role to play in that context. So I think it's really good to look at those examples as well, and to stop being sort of blind and in those regards, while of course I also see Ezekiel's question on why do we stop being broad. But you know, I think it is quite interesting to see the developments in the field also today, and then also with that in mind to see how much art, media is used for memory as well, to look back in time and look at other examples. Because many of the images also you shared with us at the very beginning are, I think, quite powerful, and I think that's a powerful tool which we should continue advocating for. Yeah, so thank you very much.
Would you like to pick on some of the...
Yeah, just quite briefly, because I would like to broaden the discussion, but thank you very much for very insightful and deep comments that will keep me thinking for quite a few days, but just to go for some sort of like undigested kind of reactions. And so first to Ezekiel's two main points, I would say, I would call the first one an issue of definitions in general, and the second of bias, if you want, and an agency. So in terms of definitions, that's a challenge that I had throughout this project. It was quite difficult to see, well, where does it end? How, and really, when you start grappling with this, you realize the power of definitions and the power of boundaries, and how exactly, as I said, wherever you draw them, you are like leaving something out. But of course, you need to have them, because everything cannot be transitional justice. So, and I think that's a challenge in this project, and I think that sort of my answer to that is what was my first sort of concluding point, in the sense of, well, even if it's not my purpose to say, well, transitional justice should be broader, but even a much more modest aim of saying, well, fair enough if you want to have a more circumscribed definition of transitional justice, because we're saying this is much more powerful, it can have more traction than having like an overbroad, vague conception that overlaps with other fields. And I don't think that necessarily that's a problem, but at the very least, I think we should have own that sort of like more limited scope, and say, well, transitional justice is about these certain practices, and you know, with the goal of having a sort of liberal democracy, or in some cases it is spelled out, but generally it isn't. And I think that's kind of like quite a modest contribution that I think that my book can offer, in the sense of, well, at the very least there is a sort of unacknowledged and implicit normativity within the discourse that I think that's not often sort of articulated. And the second point, which is about biases, is also very, very cuts to the core of my project. And interestingly, I had quite a lot of backlash on it, and people feeling quite offended, saying that, you know, I'm sort of accusing transitional justice of being purposefully biased or ignoring certain situations due to some sort of like sort of Machiavellic sort of conspiracy. And I think that the reality is that we all have biases all the time, and prejudices, and they're not necessarily bad, there are consequences of many things. Like, for instance, I've been told, oh well, but perhaps some of these cases that you mentioned haven't been taken into account because the people didn't know about it or didn't speak the language. But I think that even though, yeah, that's a perfect justification for not doing it in an individual case, overall, in aggregate, you can see, well, why there is this bias, why people who work in transitional justice don't speak these languages or are not acquainted with these other cases. And I think that this speaks of a certain sort of structural bias. So it's not anybody doing it on purpose, but it is just like the inertia of the discourse as such. And that is linked to the other, your other comment on agency. And I think that I think at one point in the conclusion of the book, I talk a little bit about it in my sort of like half-baked kind of lawyer straying beyond his zone of comfort and trying to offer some sort of like general history of ideas reflection. And I think, well, why one path and not another? And I think personally there is a combination of agency within certain structures, sort of like, you know, paraphrasing Marx, you know, just like, well, people writing their own history in certain historical circumstances. And I think that's critical here. And in many ways, the dominant history of transitional justice is what it is, because when it was written. So if it would have been written in the 60s, for example, or in the 70s, when non-liberal transitions were sort of like a viable and sort of like, to a certain extent, internationally accepted path, the history might have looked different and other examples might have been taken into account. So I think that this sort of bias is not a reflection on individual person trying to omit certain things due to some ulterior motives, but just like the sort of side case when these things happen. And I think that similarly, and this goes to Annalyn's comment in the sense of, well, you know, and also Ezekiel, well, as things change now, perhaps we can revisit some of these things that during this sort of like much vaunted end of history weren't taken into account. And then now moving to Annalyn's comments in terms of like human rights movement, I think that on both of them, I think you touched on two things that in which my thinking has been sort of progressing and my research after I finished this project. And now I'm working on a project that looks more specifically at the issue of what to do with judges that you inherit from a previous regime and the particular challenges that involves. And as part of that, I'm writing a chapter on the vetting process of judges that took place in Argentina alongside the Truth Commission and the trials I mentioned before, and because of that I had to do much more in-depth research on the Argentine transition, and one of the byproducts of my research is exactly how it's still, even though I still sort of stand by what I say in the book, that it was mainly a domestic process, but the international influence even then was quite significant, in the sense of there were, you know, the role, like, not only, as you said, the Inter-American Commission, in terms of the report, but also during the trial, as witnesses, the former, or then sort of like, Commissioner of Human Rights, or however it was called, of the UN at the time, he was a witness. There was other international experts that were witnesses as well. So I think that there was much more of an international involvement that might explain, or might help to explain why this path or another, why Argentina and not Bolivia or elsewhere. So I think that the answer lies in those connections between the human rights movements in the 70s and what happens later on. And linked to that, I think is very, very interesting also this turn towards impunity, which I sort of like hint in the book. It is quite a pivotal change in the sense of, you know, you have organizations like Amnesty International, called Amnesty International, suddenly saying, well, you know, one of our main purposes now is also to make sure that people are punished. And this could get to the point of, if necessary, undermining some of the sort of like traditional liberal protections in sort of like in criminal trials in order to defeat impunity. So I think that's a quite a pivotal turn that, I mean, there's a lot of very interesting work being done by a lot of scholars at the moment, but I think that it is a key change. Then finally, in terms of like businesses, yeah, I think that it is a a main blind spot that I think it is slowly changing, and it is changing in a way, as I said, because these processes take time. It's hard to get, especially in the context of trials, to get the sort of smoking gun to finally sort of convict people on those sort of types of charges. But I think that it is a very, very important change. And lastly, what you say about, like, you know, the sort of like interdisciplinary and the role of like both peripheral actors and sort of social civil society actors in this process is very important. And I think in that sense, although there is a certain sort of pecking order, or there are sort of like relative strength and power at play within the discourse, in the sense of some institutions have much more power, mechanisms such as criminal trials, and especially international criminal trials, sort of like soak up a lot of resources and attention that others don't. So there is like a sort of balance of power in a way. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that the subaltern actors are powerless, quite the contrary. And I think they play quite a big role in shaping the discourse, and they still keep playing a part. And in many ways, when I close with that like optimistic note, was having in mind these peripheral actors, these civil society activists that I think can hold the key to forcing changes within the discourse. And I think that's very important sort of going forward.
Thank you very much. I'm going to stop the recorder and then open.